Thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you very much for the invitation to come and talk to you. I'm very happy to be here. And yes, I'm going to talk about a recent paper we put out with my collaborators Lisa Randall and her postdoc Jacob Schultz about the prospect of explaining the core cusp problem in dwarf galaxies through Fermi repulsion. And then subsequently, I'm going to talk about some model building aspects, which is what the first paper concerns. So a lot of this talk is going to be about looking at the density profiles of dwarf galaxies. And so I mocked up this nice little image, but this is really just to sort of motivate us to think about how a density could change as a function of radius. So the outline of my talk is going to be roughly as follows. I'm going to talk about why dwarf galaxies are interesting from the point of view of dark matter. I'm going to talk about some ways which are very prevalent in literature for explaining the density profile of these dwarf galaxies. And then I'm going to talk about a fairly understudied way of explaining why the density profiles of these objects seem to be different than, say, lambda CDM would lead us to expect. This is actually the idea that you could use a degenerate Fermi gas, a dark matter as a degenerate Fermi gas, to explain this structure. I'm going to argue works quite nicely, apart from the mass range that comes out that you need doesn't quite work for a thermal relic. So then I'm going to motivate, in the second part of this talk, this idea of flooded dark matter, which was what one of our other papers was about. And in particular, this allows you to get around or relax some of these bounds from pre-streaming, the Lyman alpha bound. And then finally, I'm going to ask, can cores in dwarf galaxies come about in this flooded dark matter? And as a little answer to that, the answer is going to be not quite, but kind of it goes in the right direction. And I'll talk about how you can just get that last little push to get these degenerate Fermi gases to help core dwarfs. Okay. So dwarf galaxies are very interesting environments. They are baryon poor, gravitationally bound objects that occur quite often as orbitals of larger galaxies. Because they are so dark matter dominated, they become nice testing grounds for theories of dark matter. In particular, there are eight such Milky Way satellites called the eight classical dwarfs, they're listed here. Which are particularly nice examples. These are dwarf spheroidals, which means that they are particularly low in baryonic gas, and they're roughly spheroidal. Of course, the Milky Way now has roughly 20 dwarf galaxies that we know of, but these ones are particularly nice to study for some of these aspects I'm going to talk about. So, one of the reasons, because these dwarf galaxies are so dark matter dominated, they're particularly nice for doing things like setting mass bounds on the dark matter. So you can look at various properties of these things and you can ask, could I accommodate this with some sort of particle dark matter model? And consequently, if you take lambda CDM and you try and understand these dwarf galaxies, then you run into a number of tensions. These tensions are sort of well recorded in literature. And they go under the name of the missing satellite problem. The first one being is, I do a structure formation simulation assuming lambda CDM, and these things tend to predict, say, 100 satellite galaxies for the Milky Way. And then I go out and look for them, and let's say 5 years ago, I found a dozen. And a dozen and 100 is very different. But we just had the dark energy survey come about, and they found a whole bunch more. They're much fainter because they have less stars, and so they're very difficult to see. But now we have, say, 20, 25 of these dwarf galaxies. Now 25 and 100 is not so bad. And my understanding is that the anticipation in the community is that as we get better at looking for these dwarf galaxies, we'll find more. So there is a question about whether this is still a problem. But at the moment, we're really trying to explain an order one factor between simulations and observation, so it's still an interesting question. The too big to fail problem is somewhat related to this. It says the way we look for these dwarf galaxies is by looking for stars, and if they just don't have stars because they've been ripped off by the larger galaxy, then of course you're not going to see them, because there's nothing to see. But the missing, the too big to fail problem sort of says that these big galaxies would probably retain their stars, so that's not a great argument. So these two are sort of intrinsically tied together. And again, this might be reconciled with just more, with better detection. So what I'm going to focus on today is this thing called the core-cusp problem, which is intuitively quite easy to understand. The core-cusp problem is a conflict between the simulation, what the simulations tell us the density profile of these dwarf galaxies should be, compared to what we observe, the density profiles of these, particularly the dwarf spheroidals, are. So observations seem to imply that you have these flat density profiles that go out to, say, several hundred parsecs, maybe out to, the error bars are still quite big, but you should think out to, say, 500 parsecs to a kiloparsec. On the other hand, if I do a lambda CDM simulation, these simulations seem to favor very peaked distributions, that as I go towards the center of a dwarf galaxy, I expect my density distribution to rise very strongly. So if I refer to my little plot here, which is sort of a fictitious data plot, this is here is the sort of expected behavior for an observed dwarf galaxy. And we call these things cored, because they feature a flat core. And this very sharp profile, which shoots up towards the center, is called a cuspid profile. So, and the difference between the observation and the simulation is deemed one of the more interesting tensions, let's say, between observations of known structures and the standard theory of cold dark matter. So the next thing you could ask is, okay, so how can I resolve these two things? So the simplest thing you could possibly argue is that the simulations are just poor. I mean, the systems we're trying to model are fairly complicated. And in particular, until very recently, the simulations of these lambda CDM models tended to not include baryonic feedback effects. So that is, they would just treat structure formation of the dark matter alone, and the dark matter is just taken to be some collisionless dust, say, that's settled into some distribution. Now, of course, the baryons have some sort of, they do have interactions, and they tend to, if you put a lot of them together, they tend to expel themselves out again. And so this known as baryonic feedback effects, it's known that these will, in principle, start to smooth out the high density regions. The question is how much? And so there's a lot of back and forth in the cosmological literature about this, with the galaxy formation literature. And there is no real general consensus. Depending on which expert you talk to, they will tell you either it's clearly baryonic or it's clearly can't be baryonic. So for instance, James Binney particularly favors this idea that you can solve it all with baryons. Matt Walker, on the other hand, will tell you that it's incredibly difficult to do this, that you need something. Yes, Mina.
Of the
dark matter?
Of the structure of the galaxy. Is there dependence on the mass of the effect?
So of what? Of the density profile?
Of the core versus cusp. Meaning?
Yeah, you would expect there would be, yes, I think.
Yeah, so at what mass range this problem exists? Do we expect?
So this is particularly applied to these dwarf spheroidal galaxies.
I see.
So the things like Fornax and Sculpture. So, yeah, so, but yeah, you would expect that as you go to different types of galaxy that they give you different handles on approaching this system, but I'm not sure. I think they're even more difficult to understand.
So I think the point is that these are small guys that are so much dark matter dominated, you don't expect too much baryonic effect.
That's true.
But that's the thing that's disputed. For bigger guys, they're comparable dark matter and baryon, so it's not surprising that there is dark matter.
Yeah.
So it's hard to quantify whether it's a problem or not. But these are small ones, it seems that there shouldn't be baryonic effects, but even that's as a controversial.
Excellent.
But
thank you. Yes, question.
There's also a core-cusp problem for larger galaxies, which has been around for a long time.
And how does this present itself?
Yeah. If you fit larger galaxies, and the galaxies were called cusp problems.
Okay, that sounds very interesting.
So
and
you had to solve that too.
Yeah, so I guess one of the problems with the larger galaxies is they have a lot more baryons, and so the uncertainties are even more difficult to understand. These dwarf spheroidals are incredibly clean, and so the problem is sort of very well defined and sort of stands out a lot more. But certainly that's an interesting question. I'm not quite aware of which specific ones you're referring to.
Don't you have to put in your degenerate fermion gas for the larger galaxies?
Certainly. Well, when I come to that, I will want to do that. But, well, let's come to that shortly. So, this is certainly a nice indication that there could be some deviation from lambda CDM. It could not be not well-defined. Let's take it as such and take that as a hint of what might be going on in the hidden sector and see what sort of new ideas pop up. So very quickly after this idea took hold, there were a flurry of nice ways of solving this problem. Perhaps some of you will be aware of these. Dark matter self-interactions, of course, much like the baryons have a feedback effect, if the dark matter has a self-interaction, that can also essentially have a feedback effect, which smears out the high-density regions. Warm dark matter is a nice way of also doing this. This is essentially an argument about conservation of phase space under the structure formation. It leads to a smearing out of the central regions. There is this interesting idea about degenerate Bose gases, which has recently been sort of re-emerged with a lot of interest because of a paper by Witten and collaborators, but was proposed back as far as 1994. And this idea, which has not really taken a large amount of hold in the community, and which is why we found it very interesting, is the idea of rather having a degenerate Bose gas at the center of these dwarf galaxies, you have a degenerate Fermi gas. And so what we're really going to use here is we're going to use essentially a new pressure term from the Pauli exclusion principle to essentially give you a pressure which smears out these high-density regions.
So warm dark matter is ruled out by the lambda-alpha, right? Large-scale structure thing?
It pretty much is at this point, but you could probably... I reckon we could get around that with some clever model building, and I'll come on to that later. But sort of the classic example of a sort of a light star neutrino certainly runs into trouble. So I'll just point briefly at these other related papers on this work, but I think this is an extensive list of everyone who's thought about this idea. So what is a degenerate Fermi gas, and when is it degenerate? So we're probably all fairly familiar with these ideas from statistical physics. You're degenerate if all of your quantum states are filled up to some energy, and the condition under which you form a degenerate Fermi gas is if the temperature of the gas drops below some critical temperature marked T degenerate. This critical temperature is some function of the density and the mass of these things, and the gas fills up to some highest occupation level denoted by the Fermi velocity. Again, here, a function of the density, the mass of the particle. I may call it the dark matter particle, sort of leading on to later things, and some sort of degrees of freedom. So this NF is essentially the number of Dirac flavors of Dirac fermions. And you can take this to be one. It's not going to have any real bearing. You can also define essentially an equivalent momentum, which is going to be very useful for when we talk about the corresponding Fermi pressure. Now, the Fermi pressure in a gas of these states is defined as an integral over the various levels up all the way from 0 to PF. And again, it gives you some pressure term, which is a function of the density. Now, if I take some sort of gas of these objects, there is potentially a Fermi pressure, but there's also a classical pressure from an ideal gas. And if I assume that this gas has some sort of virial temperature distribution, like you'd expect for a galaxy, then the classical pressure has this form. It depends on the total mass enclosed and the density as some function of R. So the precise forms of these things is not going to be so important. The most important thing going forward is to notice that I essentially have two components of this, this pressure. When I'm in the highly degenerate regime, it's well modeled by this lower one, and which is the quantum pressure. And when I'm in the highly non-degenerate regime, it's given by this classical pressure. And here you can see how this how these different components change as a function of radial distance. So this is pressure on the left, radial distance on the x-axis. The classical pressure is in yellow, and it goes to small values as I go towards radially small distances, whereas the Fermi pressure remains constant. This is because of the mass dependence, the mass enclosed in the classical pressure. So what's interesting here is you see there is some critical radius where these two things switch. So I go from being a gas which is being described, which is mainly being held by this quantum pressure, to some configuration which is supported by the classical pressure. Joe?
For this plot, are we assuming a constant density inside?
Are we assuming a constant? No, we're not. We're actually going to, well, I'll come on to that in the next slide, but we're going to take a ball of fermions with some fixed central density, and then solve the equations to work out the hydrostatic equilibrium. And that's where this pressure's coming from. Let's do that immediately. Okay, so if I want to actually take a self-gravitating ball, I have these two pressure terms, which are arising, and I want to ask, what does its how does it sort of naturally equilibrate to some sort of configuration? And what does its density profile look like? So this is going to be defined in terms of these three requirements. Hydrostatic equilibrium, which is essentially saying the pressure terms out have to balance the gravitational pull in. There's a pressure equality which says that the pressure of this system experiences is the sum of the classical pressure in the quantum system and the quantum pressure. And some sort of continuity equation that says that the total mass I integrate over this this density out to some radius r.
So can I ask you, so that first term for classical pressure, that's kind of, I mean, that's really an order of magnitude thing. It could be anything like much bigger or much smaller than that, this first term.
Why do you say that? I think it's, I mean, I think I'm just using an idea, assuming it's an ideal gas.
So it should be, I mean, pressure is rho kT, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, what is temperature?
So I So I've made an assumption that the temperature is described by some the virial temperature of the gas. So it could deviate from that.
Right, but the virial condition is a global condition. It's
That's
not,
very
it's
true.
It's not valid at every point.
That's true, but it, I mean, it should sort of, on average, well describe the system. I think so. I think this is a reasonable.
Well, I mean, it depends on exactly what you want to do. Let's say you don't have a degenerate thing.
Mm-hmm.
So then, I mean, what sort of solution do you get? I guess that's the question.
You get something that looks isothermal, I guess. This is the, if you
but
don't have...
isothermal, then gm over r would be a constant. Well, I mean, that should be rho times a constant, not rho times g or m over r. So here you have a r-dependent temperature, and you say...
Yeah, exactly right. So I'm assuming that you define the virial temperature at some radius r, and so the temperature is a function of r.
Yeah, like you find a temperature that is equal to zero, the temperature goes to zero here, you're assuming, which is, I mean, not very realistic, but I mean, maybe another order of magnitude is fine.
You could argue that I admit that it's possible you could argue there could be an order one factor at the start. So we can chat about this afterwards. That's an interesting question, because it could actually be helpful.
I guess for the particular system you're considering, you might be saving the fact that degenerate pressures might take over a smaller unit.
That's certainly true. Yeah, so for the fully degenerate system,
but for fully degenerate system, it doesn't matter, right? But then...
So for the sort of strongly degenerate system, I guess, then maybe this thing drops out. But there's an interesting thing about when... So later I'm going to ask about where these different effects swap over, because this is when the classical pressure sort of overtakes the Fermi pressure, this is sort of going to be precisely how I define my core radius. Mm. And so maybe order one effects could be helpful. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts after. But I don't think this is going to have a crucial effect on the arguments. So the first thing you might like to do, if you're trying to solve this system, is simplify it a little bit. So let's set the classical pressure to zero, And then we're solving a very simple system of a fully degenerate gas. In this case, the three requirements I showed you earlier collapse down to this single differential equation, and if you assume small r, then you get a very nice approximate solution for this, which is of this form, which is a function of its the central density, rho naught, and you need to pick this scale to solve this correctly. And the appropriate scale you choose to solve this equation is of this form. Note that it's a function of the mass and the central density, and as I said, this is a number of degrees of freedom. In particular, this really is telling you the characteristic length scale where the Fermi pressure stops. And so it's going to be very closely correlated to the core sizes when I actually do the full quasi-degenerate gas. So now if we look at the full solution, where I reinstate the classical pressure, and I plot the solutions for this, this is sort of essentially what I get. Let's pick a particular mass. These are different colors correspond to different choices of the mass, of the dark matter mass, essentially. So let's look at, say, this yellow curve. Or let's look at the green curve, actually. So the case, this green case with the long extended tail is the quasi-degenerate case, whereas this thing which drops off abruptly after some finite radius is the fully degenerate case. So this is sort of exactly what you expect. And you can imagine a transition where I sort of heat this fully degenerate system so that it rises above the degeneracy pressure in the outer regions, and then I sort of smooth out into this extended distribution. So the way we talk about this is we say that these quasi-degenerate cases have thermal tails. And these thermal tails are going to be very important for describing the systems, because this idea that you have just a degenerate system is a very poor description of the actual density profiles of dwarf galaxies.
So what is the slope of that?
I think it's just isothermal.
It's one over r squared.
Yeah. Yes.
Just being simple-minded. Normally we associate degenerate Fermi gas with compact objects, neutron stars. The
exactly.
Same kind of mass. But you need a very dense object.
Very true.
To get a
very true. We will be coming onto this. But you've exactly nailed what I'm going to.
You've got to have some object sitting there. Dwarf galaxy, that's compact.
Yes, well, this is the compact core. This, if you look at this sort of distribution precisely, this is a dark matter neutron star. Now, when a neutron star forms, at the last moment it sort of blows off all of the exterior component. But here we're assuming that there's no sort of violent collapse and you sort of gently relax into this quasi-degenerate Fermi gas. So this is, you can think of this as a neutron, dark matter neutron star core with a sort of thermal, isothermal tail fall off. So that's precisely right.
One quick comment. These compact objects, neutron stars, are formed by the collapse of a star.
Yeah, so.
And what produces this object?
So, this just starts as some configuration. That's an interesting question. So the way we really envisage it is you start with some system where you have some Fermi velocity. It's degenerate in the center with some fixed Fermi velocity, and it has this sort of distribution. But the Fermi velocity in the center could be higher than the escape velocity. In that case, those states escape, the ones above the escape velocity, but then I reduce the mass. And so then the system reconfigures itself to something else, say, which has a slightly lower escape velocity and a different Fermi velocity. And any states above the escape velocity, again, escape. And so I slowly relax by this sort of, it's called in condensed matter systems evaporation cooling, into this system which is which precisely describes this. So there's no violent behavior. It's just a slow relaxation behavior into this quasi-degenerate state.
Well, neutron stars are produced by supernova explosions.
Yeah, and this is just being produced by galaxy formation. So they slowly fall in. You never go above the Chandrasekhar bound. And in fact, we checked that explicitly in the paper, but it's not actually in here. You can show that the masses are never, objects are never sufficiently big to form black holes in the center of galaxies. But it's an excellent question. We can chat more later if you want, but yeah, it's certainly a point worth checking, and we checked it. There's something very special about the neutron stars, about the mass of the proton, which means that the black hole threshold and the neutron star threshold are really close. And if you change the mass of the thing which is forming these things, so if you go away from 1 GeV, then these two things become very distinct. And so it's actually not as close as you might immediately...
But what... Sorry to keep it...
No, those are excellent questions.
You would expect some physical effect from one of these core compound objects being produced.
It's an interesting question.
We don't see that.
But these things are, you can take these to be inert. If they're inert and they have no interactions with other degrees of freedom, it's not clear what sort of effect they would make. Maybe there's some sort of gravitational wave effect.
So I don't want to slow you down, but I think you probably shouldn't call this neutron as such. You call them white dwarfs.
You could call them white dwarfs,
yeah,
sure.
Because they are non-relativistic.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Very good. But let's chat more later. But these are good questions. Okay. So. Back to my plot. So what I've done in this plot is I've taken different masses and I've plotted the degenerate limit and the quasi-degenerate limit, and in each case I've normalized the distribution so that they reproduce the Fornax half mass. So this is like the total mass enclosed at the half-light radius. Yes, excellent. So these things are actually modeling a specific measured dwarf galaxy. And this Fornax is going to show up later. So there's a couple of things which are interesting here. As I make the dark matter heavier, you'll notice that the let's talk about the degenerate case first. The degeneracy limit shrinks. And the reason why this is happening is because I have heavier objects, right? So each dark matter particle is contributing more. So to match the total mass, I need less of them. As I make the dark matter lighter, I need more of them, and as they fill up, this slowly drives the distribution out to larger radius. And this is true both for the degenerate case and for essentially this changeover from the classical to degenerate behavior. So you can see that my flat cores in the quasi-degenerate cases are pushed out to larger radii. Now, what I realized to do is fit this to observation somehow. So I said there's a core cost problem, but I haven't really said, I haven't really defined that very sharply. And in fact, it's sort of difficult to define sharply, at least until very recently. So first let's ask, what do we mean by a core radius? So I gave you this, initially I gave you this idea about the static, if I take the static solution with the classical gas set to zero, then there's a characteristic length scale that comes out from where the Fermi pressure ends. And that is defined by this. There's also this idea that you can think about when does the classical pressure become comparable to the Fermi pressure? And that's defined by this condition. And if I actually look at where this happens, where this radius occurs on my plot of classical pressure and Fermi pressure, it's actually being given by this dotted line for this specific example. Here is the intersection point where the pressure terms are equal, and so you can see these things are roughly comparable. Of course, these definitions are only valid for my particular scenario where I'm talking about a degenerate Fermi gas. So you'd like to talk more generally. What if I take some observation, when do I say that I am in a flat core region, and when do I say that I'm in some sloping region? And so a definition which shows up in the literature is you simply define this as the gradient of this thing hitting some particular value. 3/2 seems to be a favored pick, but you can potentially argue that could be different. The nice thing is, because I'm really studying a very simple system, there's only one characteristic length scale. And you can show this by dimensional analysis, and if you do, you get this. And you can sort of see that the physics is very simple. So really, we expect these quantities to all coincide, and thankfully they do. So henceforth, when I say RC, I'm going to talk about this specific definition, because this one is the one which I need to use to compare to observation. So, It's actually interesting that it's very difficult to measure what when you change from a flat core to a sloping core. And I think that only very recently, let's say 2012, was the first sort of measurement of this type with error bars on both sides actually made. And these error bars are pretty poor. So what this tells you, though, it tells you a couple of things very which are quite interesting. It tells you that there is an appreciable core. I think these are 1 sigma error bars, so if I get a value down to 2 sigma, maybe 200 parsecs is acceptable. Actually, these are 2 sigma error bars, I think. No, 1 sigma. And at 2 sigma, this allows cores up to, say, 2.6 kiloparsecs, which is most of the dwarf galaxy. But we expect this to come down and become more, these error bars to become tighter as experiments get much better and techniques improve. I can talk to you a little bit about the challenges of extracting this offline, but it's some very interesting physics which is being pioneered by Walker and Amoresco and a couple of other groups. But if we actually take the quasi-degenerate Fermi gas scenario, which I just sort of sketched out, and I ask, when does the core radius, which I extract, match these error bars, it really now just becomes a function of the mass. In fact, even the degrees of freedom sort of factor out, because any change in the degrees of freedom, it's an interesting fact that any change in RC for the number of degrees of freedom actually sort of vanishes, because it does sort of slightly change the distribution of the Fermi gas, but the same of the extent, but at the same time, I have more occupation levels that I can occupy. And so you actually find all of those factors, all of that factors out. So now it just becomes a function of the mass. And here on the plot, I show the core radius as a function of a given dark matter mass, assuming that it forms a quasi-degenerate Fermi gas. So for a dark matter mass of about, 400 eV, I can get cores of, say, 150 parsecs out. And for a mass of about, 70 eV, I get a core radius of about 2.6 kiloparsecs. And so these are the 2 sigma deviations on the observed core radius of 4 naps. It tells you a couple of interesting things. The first thing it tells you is the dark matter has to be very light in order to give appreciable cores from Fermi repulsion. The second thing it tells you is that you can actually put a conservative lower bound on the mass of the dark matter from these observations. So what we do is make a sort of variant on the Tremaine-Gunn bound. So the Tremaine-Gunn bound says something about packing in fermion or even boson dark matter into some dwarf galaxy. But they make some specific assumptions about phase space and conservation. What they're really talking about is if I make the dark matter very light, then length scales associated to objects become very large. And that's really what we're extracting. So the argument we want to make is there's an upper bound on the observed core sizes of some system. And that means that if I make the dark matter much lighter than this lower bound of 70 eV, then the core sizes we would observe exceed the length scale of this. And so this is actually, this assumes nothing, essentially. So this is actually more conservative than the Tremaine-Gunn bound, but it's only it's only a little bit weaker. So it's weaker by a factor of maybe 2. But, yes, 2 questions.
Yeah, go ahead, go.
So if you have a baryonic feedback, it only makes it worse, or?
If you have baryonic, that's an interesting question. If you have baryonic feedback, it only makes it worse, because you would expect it to make the cores larger.
So this is a quasi-degenerate zero temperature moment?
No, this is quasi-degenerate, but it's not zero temperature. It has some, we assume some varial temperature distribution.
Okay.
Yes?
That formula, that curve is probably some analytic formula, but this should be some Planck mass and, I guess, dark matter mass, different powers, right?
I mean, you could think it's really just this. I think it's really just this.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. Okay.
It's there's some slight deviation, I think,
yeah,
because
okay.
We're doing the fully, but RC Which is the fully degenerate case.
That's
is
what
this,
I was
yeah.
Yeah. And what is rho naught?
Rho naught is the central density.
Okay, so what?
Of this subject.
You fix that to something?
I think you can actually solve for that once you have the.
Ah, so that, yeah. Okay, so that's a different question. So the question is, so that's the, but, I mean, the thing is that for neutrino stars, for example, where there is zero temperature, there is, you could have, there is a mass radius relationship,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, you could have any radii. And here you somehow you're fixing the radius, and that's the thing that's not clear to me. What is fixing the radius? For neutrino stars, you could have any radius, basically. I mean, because of initial conditions, we only get the small ones. But I mean, there is a mass radius relationship, and the solutions to the hydrostatic equilibrium could have any radius.
It looks like we're in the very low temperature regime of this degenerate ball, so it's kind of like the neutrino star in the zero temperature. Are you saying that there's some?
But my point is that nothing fixes, at least for the neutrino star case, nothing fixes the radius. You could have any radius. And here it seems that some is saying something fundamental.
But the masses. I mean, I know what I'm matching to a known. I think this is the point. I'm matching to a known dwarf galaxy which has a fixed mass. So we know the mass.
Oh, you fix the total mass.
We fix the total mass to be consistent with the Fornax galaxy, and this is a measured Fornax radius. But, yeah, but in principle, yes. If you don't know the mass, then you can change the radius.
So it's like then it's similar to neutrino star that's a mass radius relationship.
And the mass radius.
Maybe this is the same question, but
yes.
It sounds like you've got a prediction then for where this crossover radius should be as a function of the mass of the galaxy.
Excellent. Next point. So, yes. So if I take this, as you both very well observe, there is a correlation between the radius and the dark matter mass and the central density, which is going to be equivalent to that.
Yes.
And this simply comes from taking this critical radius and taking both, just sort of rearranging, it's just algebra now. And what it tells you is that this quantity is a constant, and so there's some scaling relationship. And it actually tells me that if I look at a plane of radius versus mass of these objects, then they lie across diagonal lines like this. So this is, say, for an 800 eV state, and these are where we fit the 8 classical dwarfs. So there are actually only 5 dots, but that's because they sort of they the points overlap each other. And so this is for 500 eV, and this is for 200 eV. Now, let me tell you the rest of this plot, because it's actually a very interesting plot that we took from a nice paper by Burkert, a very recent paper. I think there are some older papers who were sort of remarking on similar things, but these people have said it very clearly. They remarked that if you take rho, the central density, and a core radius defined some in terms of this density slope I defined earlier, then the dwarf galaxies, the classical dwarfs, follow a scaling relationship which looks like this. Rho RC goes like roughly 75, and that's this line here, this central line. The error bars on this are given here. But Burkert also argued that the large galaxies like Milky Way galaxies, Milky Way galaxies, also seem to follow this distribution. So he claims in this paper that there's an interesting scaling relationship that carries on at mass scales of quite different. This is a log scale, right? So this is like 2 to 2.5 orders of magnitude in mass scale, and this is somewhat not understood. But one thing which is very neat is that if you actually take this scaling relationship we have and restrict it to the mass range that give observable size cores, then you sort of naturally land in the right ballpark to be explaining these things. Or rather, not explaining perhaps, but lying on the same correlation line. So I bring this up more as a curiosity than anything else, but it's certainly very interesting.
I don't understand that because the lines aren't parallel, right? So how do you explain?
What I say is, so this Burkert relationship tells me that I should be lying along this trajectory. Our scaling relationship tells us that we should lie here or here, depending on mass. Mm-hmm. And if I restrict the mass range of, say, 200 eV to 500 eV particles, which are what give me the right core sizes to explain observations in Fornax, then this naturally sort of sweeps out this
But in nature, there's only one mass, right? So wouldn't you be predicting everything's aligned on the steeper line?
Yes, I mean, you get one steep line, but the steep, to explain already the core radius, the steep line should lie either here or here. And the fact that all of the dwarfs we fit to sort of fill up this region too is intriguing, but not... Does that make sense?
So the rest of that, the evidence, whatever the evidence is for the scaling, you're saying is explained by some other thing. It's not your...
Yeah, so it doesn't explain why you get these things down here, but it's curious that we land in the right ballpark.
So the picture is that if you go over to a galaxy and you measure where the dark matter dominates, you know, relative to the regular matter, it's only in some galaxies, like the low surface brightness ones, where it's this degeneracy that's in charge, and the other ones is something else.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's an interesting question why these would fit, but
I guess
it's at least curious.
I think if you want to be probably more rigorous, basically the your points are really a lower limit, I think, because you could have things that are completely non-degenerate and they get ignored for some other reason, for aspects,
precisely.
Other reasons, right?
Yeah.
So those would be the black guys that are out there at much bigger.
Oh yes, yes.
But then, so there's a minimum size core that you can get from the degeneracy pressure, and yeah, so they cannot go below that. So your points would be like a lower limit, I think. That would be. You could get anything to the right of it, but you cannot get anything to the left of it. If you fix the mass, that is the procedure.
Yes.
But that makes sense. I think so. Unless.
So I don't want to dwell on this. It's a curiosity. So yes, I have a few more things I'd like to say. So I'm going to use I can get 10 more minutes, right? Or, yeah. So let me just come on to the thing, the crucial thing which I've sort of been avoiding for the last 40 minutes, which is that this mass is really light. We're talking about hundreds of EV. And hundreds of EV are problematic because they wipe out small-scale structure. In particular, there's this very famous Lyman alpha bound, which is now a textbook sort of argument, which says that dark matter should be greater than 3 keV. But this assumes something very critical. This assumes that the dark matter is essentially a thermal relic. It assumes that it was in thermal equilibrium in the early universe, and it freezes out, and that's why you would wash out this these small-scale structures. So if I make the dark matter non-thermal, can I do better than 3 keV? Can I get to lower masses? And the answer is yes, and I wanted to sketch you a particular model where you can start to see this. So this comes from another paper that Jacob and Lisa and I put out called Flooded Dark Matter, which is an interesting way of describing an interesting alternative, quite radical in some sense, to some of the scenarios which exist in the literature. And this automatically gives you a relaxed free streaming bound. So let me just sketch our motivation, our initial thinking. We like the idea that, so in the early universe, inflation occurs, possibly, probably, depending on how you feel. But at the very least, it's a good guess. Now, this means that at some point, all of the energy density of the universe is tied up in the inflaton. And the inflaton should decay to the light degrees of freedom. Now, the standard models certainly constitute a bunch of light degrees of freedom, but there's no real reason to think that they constitute all of, or even most of the light degrees of freedom. So if I consider some sort of string theory, or some sort of large gut group, I can imagine I could have n decoupled sectors, which only really communicate via, say, gut scale physics or Planck scale physics. In this case, there's no reason to think the inflaton will decay just to our states. Most naturally, you could expect it to decay democratically to all of these sectors. And this means that our standard model only picks up a fraction of the energy density. And also the entropy density. If these states have light degrees of freedom, then they start to contribute to things like number of effective degrees of freedom, and you run into trouble. You also can't really match onto late-time cosmology, because you expect at some point in the universe that we're sort of radiation dominated by the thermal bath of baryons and photons in order to explain known cosmology, and so it becomes a bit of a problem. If I have this democratic reheating of the inflaton, how does all the energy density end up in the standard model at late time? So the simplest way to do this is to somehow, if you insist on democracy in the early universe, you need to somehow break democracy in the sort of moderately late universe.
I thought you were going to say you need republic every.
No, it's too painful to make political jokes at the moment. So, So we do this. The nice, the sort of the cleanest, nicest way to do this is by some sort of late-time entropy injection. Think, for instance, a moduli decay. But here, I want my moduli to be preferentially taught to one sector. So it's not really a moduli, but this is sort of the idea. I have some long-lived state that decays preferentially to the standard model, and its decays reheat the standard model up to some temperature, and that temperature we really call the reheat temperature. So it's after that second reheating phase that you go through things like BBN and all of the rest of history. So I'm going to parameterize this with some state phi initially and just talk through very briefly how this sort of system goes. And then I'm going to sort of give you a quick toy example where phi is, say, the right-handed neutrino, which is a perfectly nice example. What I want to do is when I start in the early universe, all of my energy density is sort of equally distributed between these various states. There's my dark matter in green, my standard model in blue, and some heavy state phi. And these things, they just, the energy density sort of just goes away as I go to the larger cosmological time, which I'll mark in terms of the FRW scale factor, simply because of expansion. Now, this evolution you can describe by the Friedmann equation, which is this form. At some point, when the temperature drops below the mass of my heavy state, this thing no longer starts redshifting like radiation, but starts redshifting like a non-relativistic particle. And that means rather than being diluted by the fourth power of the difference of scale factors, it goes like the third power. Now, the interesting thing about this is that that means that it starts to dominate the energy density of the universe after some time.
So it means that it's not completely thermalized, it's a standard model.
That's right. So if it's thermalized, this is a problem. So I'm assuming these are all decoupled, essentially.
Oh.
I mean, and that's why phi is going to be sort of long. Phi is long-lived because it has very small couplings.
So they are all decoupled, but your SN and your DM should be because
no, they're not thermally coupled, but we just assume they're sort of, they receive comparable energy densities to start. And then they only cool by expansion.
But then dark matter is not thermal dark matter.
Dark matter is definitely not thermal dark matter. So, after some period of time, all of the energy density accrues in the heavy state. And this equation here, you can drop these terms quite happily, and you simplify down to something fairly nice. By nice, I mean simple. So what happens is this state phi sort of just persists for a while. It dominates the energy density of the universe, and then it decays. And by assumption, at this point, we are assuming that phi decays just to the standard model states. And so when this decay happens, there's a transfer of energy density. And the transfer of energy density is such that the standard model, which was previously just tracking the dark matter energy density, gets boosted up to some substantially higher level. At this point, you can ask how long has it taken for this thing to decay? And so we can look at the duration that this thing has been redshifting differently for, and that thing is related precisely to its decay rate. Recall that these things are going to decay when the Hubble rate is comparable to the decay rate. And so I can ask, what is the ratio? Well, how much energy density does this state have when it does decay? Well, it has some initial amount, and then the amount of time it's been redshifting differently. And so you get a very nice simple form, which depends just on the mass of the state, which is sort of controlling when it started redshifting differently, and on its decay rate, which depends on when it stops when it stops existing and just transfers its energy density. And the interesting thing is, if you only assume after its decay, to the reheating of the standard model, you assume that everything else is just due to cosmological expansion. And here I'm ignoring degrees of freedom throughout, but they're in the paper if you're curious about factors of order few. Then the ratio of entropy densities at the time this thing decays, or energy densities in fact, is equivalent to the ratio of energy densities at late time. It's simply because nothing else of interest is really happening. And this ratio of energy densities at late time, or entropy densities, the standard model, the dark matter entropy density over the standard model entropy density, can be related to observed quantities now. So this product, or rather this ratio is related to the baryon number now, the difference between the amount of dark matter and the amount of baryons, and then some function of the mass, the dark matter mass. And we know all of these apart from the dark matter mass, which means we know this at late time, and which means we know what ratio of energy densities we need to have when this heavy state decays. Oh, I just note here on this plot that at some point baryogenesis has to happen. And baryogenesis is sort of a model, it's a free parameter in there, or like a free add-on section. But ultimately, it gives you a number which you have to account for. So what you really require is that these two lines are comparable. And that is what this requirement is doing. So I can put all these things together now. I have a requirement that the ratio of these energy densities at the point of decay match on to the observed quantities. And I have a form of the ratio of energy densities at reheating, which is a function of when it starts redshifting differently to the relativistic states and when it decays. And so I can actually just solve this and ask, what is the required lifetime of this state as a function of dark matter mass, which I've called mx here, unfortunately, and also as a function of the mass of the decaying state. And so I get this, and this precisely determines the relic density. So much like in freeze-out, you would determine the relic density by some annihilation cross-section, or freeze-in, you would determine the relic density by some production cross-section. Here we have a new knob to turn in order to determine the relic density, and that is the lifetime of this state. But there's one other thing that this state does when it decays, and that it reheats the standard model. Now, the standard model has, there's a requirement on the standard model that I reheat it above the temperatures of Big Bang nuclear synthesis, otherwise I won't match the sort of observed abundances of primordial elements. And so again, that puts a requirement on this reheat temperature that should be above, say, 10 MeV. That's the sort of ballpark figure. And so what we have is actually a competition between these two requirements. You want a very small decay rate, so you can dilute the dark matter sufficiently so you match the late time abundance. But you want a particularly high dark matter decay rate, so you can get the reheat temperature large. And this will help us to constrain the parameter space. So if I can have a few more minutes, I will tell you about quite how you constrain that parameter space. But I just want to ask if there are any questions about the model.
Is there an actual, the gamma you need, is it some recognizable scale, or is it something you just...
So like I said, the gamma you need is a function of the masses, the dark matter mass and the phi mass. But I'm going to argue that there's particularly, you know, there's going to be a nice model to end with. So I'll push forward to that. So as I sort of sketched out, we want to match the relic density, we want to reheat above BBN, baryogenesis should occur, but that's trivial. Everyone has half a dozen models of baryogenesis. We need the reheat temperature to be sufficiently high that you have a thermal bath of these in the early universe. Probably means you can't push them above, say, the gut scale. And finally, the dark matter should be warm or cold. It shouldn't be hot, as of course we want. So that brings on to this particularly nice facet of this class of models, which is how we tie into the core-cusp problem. And the fact is that because I do this late-time reheating, it actually means that my dark matter is colder, substantially, potentially, than the visible sector. Because when I met these two things, whilst they may have been tracking each other, or for, say, a thermal relic, their temperatures are the same. In this case, the temperatures have been split by this entropy injection. And the actual degree of this splitting is tied to the change in the entropy densities. And so it's actually tied to this, this observable factor that you can extract and compare to late-time observables. And because of this, what this means is because the hidden sector temperature is colder, the dark matter states go non-relativistic earlier. And so although you might be looking at, say, the Lyman alpha lines when you hit some critical temperature in the standard model, the dark matter could have gone non-relativistic quite a while longer than you would expect for a thermal relic. And this is what allows you to relax this bound from 3 keV down to 500 eV. So there's an important point here, though, which is because these ratios of temperatures are actually telling you what the late time abundance is, you can't make them arbitrarily small because there's some competition between dropping the dark matter mass and dropping the time when it goes non-relativistic. And that's why you can't relax this bound to be indefinitely small. It has some fixed value that you can calculate. And details of that in our paper. But now let's come on to look at the parameter space of this model. So I've told you what the various constraints are. We have a requirement that dark matter mass satisfies the Lyman alpha bound. So this is a dark matter mass on the bottom. This is mass of the decaying state, phi, on the side. And then I'm going to plot contours of the couplings which I need for this state to give me the correct relic density. And I'm going to assume that the decay rate can be parameterized in terms of some coupling times the mass of this state over 8 pi. So I'm assuming that it just decays as two-body decays. These are the contours. You see I have a fairly wide range of contours. I have 10 to the minus 3 works pretty well. 10 to the minus 15 works well. An interesting thing here is that larger couplings, i.e. more natural couplings, push me down to smaller masses. So you might naturally expect very light dark matter to come out in these models. This purple line at the top is the requirement that I have a thermal bath of phis. And these two blue bands are my requirements coming from my phenologically viable reheat temperature. So this is the strong band. I'm above 100 MeV, so that I satisfy BBM. And then they have a slightly stronger band we put on, which is we might want to be above 100 GeV so we can do electroweak baryogenesis or use sphalerons to process asymmetries. But you see the parameter space is rather large, but it's non-trivially constrained. And I can allow masses up to, say, 10 to the 6 GeV. So here's my nice toy example. I consider a seesaw mechanism where I add some new right-handed neutrino in. This is sort of the classic seesaw mechanism. And then I fix the Yukawas in a particular way. I say, OK, perhaps the Yukawas of the neutrino sector mimic the lepton sector. This means that this is essentially going to be the tau Yukawa, the lepton Yukawa, the mu Yukawa, and the electron Yukawa. And if that's the case, then to match the rough mass scale of these neutrinos, it tells me that M needs to be around 10 to the 9 GeV. Now, the interesting thing here is that with a coupling, so the states with larger couplings decay first and their energy density redshift away. It's only the longest lived state we really need to worry about. That is the lightest of these guys. Well, this is the guy with the smallest Yukawa. So it's the guy that carries the electron Yukawa. The electron Yukawa is 10 to the minus 6. So I lie on this contour. And I say that I have a mass of 10 to the 9. So I sort of live in this green blob. And the interesting thing here is this model sort of naturally picks out very light dark matter suitable for when these Fermi effects in dwarf galaxies start to become important. The other thing this predicts, which is quite nice, is you get a very hierarchical set of neutrino masses. You get two heavy ones, where one has the tau Yukawa, one has the mu Yukawa. These are rather large, and then you get one which is substantially lighter than the other two. So, does this work? That's of course the important question. And the answer is almost. This almost works perfectly well. As I said before, though, you can't make the dark matter the Hidden sector arbitrarily cold. And this means you can't ameliorate the Lyman alpha bounds indefinitely. And there is some definite bound that you can calculate. And the bound, when you do it very carefully, comes out to be 470 EV. Now, recall I told you that the target range for explaining Fornax was 70 eV to 400 eV. So it gets very close, but it doesn't quite get into the range you'd want.
Yes. You have this lower bound, but I want to ask if you have any self-interaction, can you actually...
It's a good question. Potentially that could help, yeah. But it sort of goes away from the bare bones, minimalistic model we're building. So yeah, so what do we need? What could help with this? So one of the first things that you could argue is that when I divide this pore size from experiment, I fit to a specific profile. In fact, one thing I glossed over for time purposes is that we actually do two profile fits. This blue bound is where we fit to the Burkett profile, and this extension by the green is where we fit with some two distinguished radii. And so actually how you fit this the profile of these things actually can change what you expect the core radius to be. And of course, if you have maybe an order one factor in the classical pressure, this would also have some sort of impact. So maybe you could actually shift this slightly, and it could help. The other thing is, maybe you generate moderately large cores, and there are baryonic feedback effects, which just enhance them by a factor of two. So maybe the aim of this game is actually to generate, say, 100 parsec cores, and they get blown out to 200, 300, 400 parsecs by baryonic effects. The other possibility, which actually, in principle, allows you to arbitrarily avoid the Lyman alpha bounds, is you can try and skew the momentum distributions. So for a given temperature, I expect some sort of Boltzmann distribution of their velocities. And this tells me that you use this factors into your Lyman alpha calculation. Because what I really care about is their velocities, rather than any other specific detail. And if their velocities are sort of skewed to lower, or if their energies are skewed to lower momentums, then in principle, these things will not have the same impact on Lyman alpha. And this actually shows up in some examples. Axions are an excellent example of this. These are produced non-relativistically. And therefore, there is no free streaming constraint in these things. Of course, axions are bosons, and so they don't really help me do Fermi degeneracy arguments. But a classic example of these resonantly produced stellar neutrinos via the Shi-Fuller mechanism. These things, the production mechanism is not thermal, but rather they have some interesting oscillating scenario where it actually picks out the lower momentum states and converts them into stellar neutrinos. Yes?
This momentum distribution is a dark matter momentum distribution?
This is just a toy one that I sketched to sort of give you an impression. But
this is for dark matter?
Yeah, for the dark matter.
But the dark matter is inert, so how does the momentum get changed?
You can do this, for instance, if you have a larger hidden sector and you have changes in degrees of freedom in a manner that doesn't reheat it. We have an example in the paper. You can also look at different production mechanisms. I'm sort of talking generally now. The other possibility is if it's inert, there's interesting ideas called preheating that show up in the inflation literature. These preheating are non-perturbative effects which transfer energy density from the inflaton, and these have a tendency to lead to highly non-thermal momentum distributions. And so there are ideas for how you can generate very skewed momentum distributions to what you'd expect, but they require a little bit of model building trickery. So let me just summarize and then I'll be done. So I started off by trying to sort of argue that the core cusp problem is particularly interesting of the three small scale structure problems. It's one that's likely to persist into the future. There doesn't really seem a consensus that you can solve this with baryonic effects. And so I think this really does present at least a tension with lambda CDM. So it's what we're thinking about in terms of dark matter model building. If you want to describe dark matter as a quasi-degenerate Fermi gas and try and solve the core cusp problem like that, then this puts you into this mass range of 70 eV to 400 eV. And so it requires interesting model building. And really, this is sort of perhaps the most minimal way, other than baryons, of solving this problem. Also, it's one of the most understudied ways of solving this problem. There are only 4-5 papers on this versus, say, Bose-Einstein condensates, which already have 300 papers on this. So I think there are a lot of interesting questions that could be approached and answered in this framework. And it seems highly reasonable. I mean, we have examples of systems like this in nature, and these are neutron stars and white dwarfs. And so the idea that the dark matter could form a quasi-degenerate Fermi gas in a dwarf galaxy means that dwarf galaxies would be galactic-scale quantum systems, which is sort of really neat. I then went on to talk about this sort of new model of dark matter that we've been sketching out. In particular, it's what got us thinking about these dwarf galaxies when we realized that you get substantially lighter dark matter in this. We started wondering, can Fermi repulsion really have an impact on astrophysics? And this led us to this idea. And this is a really neat idea too, because what it tells you is that you're setting the relative density not by an annihilation rate or a decay rate, but by some lifetime at some state. And so that's sort of distinct, and we like this facet. And again, there are lots of nice models you can build in this direction. The decaying state could be, you know, an axion, it could be a right-hand neutrino. And really, this framework is a sort of a generalization of the moduli picture of reheating. And so I think there's lots of interesting avenues you could explore in this. One last thing to remark is that I didn't really talk about here is that this framework avoids the unitarity bound. So there's a classic unitarity bound of Griesk and Kamkowski, which say that a thermal relic shouldn't be heavier than about 100 TeV. But this thing is not a thermal relic, and so you're quite happy to push this up to higher energies. And it's the fact that you get things like entropy injections that can really that help you match onto the relic density at late time. And so I'm going to close just by highlighting this recent paper of Joe and I, where we've sort of taken these ideas and we've taken a different twist on them. So if you're interested in this idea of setting the relic density with entropy injections, I will encourage you to also take a look at this. And thank you very much. Yes.
There's one item missing on your solutions for the dwarf galaxy problem.
Okay.
That's modified gravity without dark matter.
Does it work for dwarf galaxies?
It's published.
I don't know. I don't doubt that. That is possibly true. I don't know how this works actually. Perhaps you can tell me how does it call the galaxy?
The problem is observation is that the dispersion velocities predicted by the Matheson simulations do not fit the data.
Okay. So the problem with the dispersion velocities is they are they're not particularly constrained observation.
No,
you're talking about the projected line of sight.
No, it's
just
line widths.
Sorry?
Line
widths. Okay.
Yeah. So they don't fit, significantly not fitting standard dark matter profiles. You have to, eventually the idea is that we're supposed to detect dark matter particles.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the Webb story is not doing well at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So what about fitting detecting this dark matter particle?
Yeah, so detection is a little bit tricky in this case. So the problem with detecting in this case is it's essentially inert. So, I mean, yeah. But, I mean, there are sort of handles you can get. If it decays, this is helpful because you can look for indirect detection signals. It doesn't need to decay. In the specific example I sketched with a right-hand neutrino, it tells you some correlated things, like it gives you a prediction for the hierarchy in the neutrino masses, which could be indicative. And also perhaps there are some cosmological observables you can try and get a handle on. But I agree, direct observations are tricky. I think there's another question at the back if we can take. Yes,
two quick ones. So the first one thing I can guess the answer, probably this has no anything to make with the Tully-Fisher relationship, right?
We haven't really said anything about the Tully-Fisher relationship, but the Tully-Fisher relationship can sort of potentially come out of structure formation, right? I mean, it's a standing problem in dark matter models. Typically don't explain the Tully-Fisher relationship.
Yeah,
I don't
probably
think.
Related to your quest to the mass dependence of the crossover radius. The other question is, since you have a degenerate Fermi gas,
mm-hmm.
if you had any residual attractive interactions, you'd have a Cooper period instability. Have you thought about making the model of that? Or
we thought about it. We haven't got any specific. Yeah. But that's an excellent point.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
So there are some parallelogenesis model that based on like heavy state decay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So in particular, the right-hand right-hand neutrino model we sketched would work particularly well because right-hand neutrino with a mass of 10 to the 9. Actually, it was on this slide, but I didn't really talk about it. You could have to do some sort of non-thermal electrogenesis where this thing falls out of equilibrium, it decays. It's just classic CP violating effects of a right-hand neutrino, and then you want to transfer this via scalar effects, the baryons.
Does it point you to a specific coupling? Can you make it like... Yeah,
well, these couplings are pretty large. The large ones are pretty large. I think this works. We did check the details, but I think you're in the parameter range where this can work. But
it would be even better if you can like make it very predictive.
The problem is that it's the state which last state which decays, which is has like a coupling of 10 to the -6, which is really going to dominate this. Which means the CP violating couplings are all going to be around 10 to the -6. But my recollection is that this does it is in a parameter region where you can get this to work.
Any more questions? Step James again.